The passage we have just read from the letter to the Romans speaks very specifically about a certain kind of people. People who are called Jews. At the beginning of this passage, and again at the end, Paul specifically refers to the Jew. Now, we do not see ourselves as Jews. That isn't our background. That isn't our culture. And so we must ask, is this passage for us? Or can we come to it simply as having a kind of historical interest that it would be fascinating to know about and then pass on and leave it at that? No, indeed. This passage is for us. And it is for us in a very searching way. Because we have a great deal in common with these people whom Paul addresses as the Jews. And the message he directs to them is certainly for people like us, who are religious, church-going, have the Bible, know what Christianity means. It is certainly for us. Now, the problem here is that these people, these Jews, made certain assumptions simply because they were Jews. And they made the assumption that because of all the things they had as part of their provision, the law and all of those other things, somehow or other, they were quite right spiritually. Their trust was in the wrong place. So we need to look at them and to learn about that danger, that we may avoid it. So let's look down what Paul says here concerning these people and apply that to ourselves. First of all, the possession of great privileges does not make you a Christian. If you call yourself a Jew, Paul says. Now, it wasn't wrong to do that. It all depends on how you do it. And that was the problem. Because when they called themselves Jews, they did it in a way that was presumptuous. They knew they had great privileges. But they assumed that because they had these privileges, they must necessarily be in a good state spiritually. If anyone in the world was going to go to heaven, it would surely be them. And the privileges were good, and they were real. They had the law. They had been taught God's will. They knew that it was to the Jews that God had made himself known as the sovereign Lord. And they assumed that therefore, because of all of this, they must have a right and special relationship with him. They had privileges that others didn't have. Wasn't it therefore the case that they must be fine? Spiritually, they must be fine. Simply having those privileges, that's all that mattered. They said, "We are Jews," but they said it presumptuously. And then when they called themselves Jews, they also sounded very superior. You'll notice they looked around at the Gentile world, and in a superior way, they decided that these Gentiles should be really grateful that we're here. What would they do without us? We are the only people who can tell them the right way to live. We're the only people who can teach them what they need to know. Look at verses 19 and 20. They're convinced that they are guides for the blind, lights for those who are in the dark, instructors of the foolish, teachers of the immature. But it all sounds very superior. You call yourself a Jew. That's true. You have a great heritage. You have great privileges. But there's something wrong about the sound of it. Because when you call yourself a Jew, it sounds presumptuous. And you sound superior. And so Paul comes here to demolish that presumption and to remove any thought of superiority. Now, we this morning are people who have wonderful, wonderful privileges. I've said earlier to the children that they are growing up in Christian homes. What greater privilege could there be? We are all able to read the Bible in our own language. What a privilege that is. We belong to a church where the gospel is believed and honored, and Christ is worshipped as Lord. What a privilege. But we must never assume that having these privileges means that we are Christians. And we must never allow an attitude of superiority to take up lodging in our hearts. That happens easily, doesn't it? That can happen so easily. We're living in days of biblical illiteracy. People know virtually nothing about the Bible. But we know about the Bible. And we hear them trying to answer questions on quiz programs, and they don't know whether Jonah lived in the Old Testament or the New Testament, and we say, well, I know that. And we may fall into the trap of feeling a little superior. And on the Lord's Day, you don't find us in the shopping centre or mowing our lawn like those Gentiles do. And we may begin to feel a little superior and lift ourselves a few more steps up the spiritual ladder. Don't ever let ourselves become presumptuous because of the privileges we have or show a trace of feeling superior. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed about himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, and I give a tenth of all that I get. The possession of great privilege is a wonderful thing, a blessing for which we must be truly and constantly thankful. But it doesn't make you a Christian. In fact, it confronts you with some very searching questions. You then, who teach others, do you not teach yourself? You who preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that people should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who brag about the law, do you dishonor God by breaking that law? Does your conduct match your orthodoxy? Because you are saying the right things and you are knowing the right things and you are approving of the right things and you are agreeing that the Ten Commandments are excellent. Does your life, says Paul, match your profession You are talking the talk. Are you walking the walk? Because if you're not, then he says the consequences could not be more serious. God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. People in the world draw their conclusions about the character of God from the conduct of his people. If those who profess to be Christians are inconsistent, the world will notice, and it will cause people in the world to scorn his name. And we have unfortunately heard that happening because of the behavior of those who profess to be Christians. He's a Christian, but I know he's been involved in some shady deals. He's always at church, but you don't look at him sideways. He's got a short fuse. He's a man who tells us about his church attendance. But have you ever listened to him? He can't speak about anyone without running them down. Isn't it frightening, that thought, that our inconsistency could have such a terrible effect? We do have great privileges. Don't be presumptuous and think that having great privileges means you're saved. Don't look at your privileges and then think you're superior. Don't abuse your privileges and live inconsistently. Secondly, the apostle says here that the observance of good practices does not make you a Christian. The possession of great privileges does not make you a Christian, nor does the observance of good practices make you a Christian. In the days of Abraham, God had given the Jewish people a sign. It's called circumcision. Back in Genesis, that's the sign that's given. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your offspring after you. This is my covenant which you shall keep. Every male among you shall be circumcised. And Paul speaks here of circumcision, a sign set upon all Jewish men. A covenant sign, a visual sermon which spoke of God's promise to bestow the blessing of salvation on his people. And this visual sermon was calling every Jewish man to live as a faithful member of the covenant, to enter truly into the covenant. How did he do that? He did it in his heart, by trusting God, by devoting his life to God, and by living in obedience to God's law. It was right that the Jewish man should be circumcised, that the covenant sign be placed upon him. It was right that Jewish parents, in faith and obedience, bring their sons to be circumcised. But they needed to remember something. That circumcision always points beyond itself. Because that's what signs do. I showed the children this morning the sign of two children crossing the road. That points beyond itself to the possibility of that the driver must acknowledge that there actually will be children crossing, real children crossing the road. Signs point to the reality, to great spiritual realities. And that's what circumcision did. It spoke of great spiritual realities. It spoke of the gospel, the removal of sin, the cutting away of sin, the renewing of the heart. Paul speaks, and you notice at the end of this passage, about the circumcision of the heart. That's the reality. That's the reality. And if the reality is not there, then the fact that someone has been circumcised is actually meaningless. Verse 28, a man is not a Jew if he is only one outwardly, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. And that was the problem, because the Jews stopped short. They were content to have the sign, though they didn't have the reality. So what does that mean for us? Well, there is still a covenant sign. Now it is baptism. And in Colossians 2, Paul links baptism and circumcision together in the same verses, the same sentences, because they're speaking of the same spiritual realities. The mode of the covenant sign has changed. The message of the sign is the same. And baptism is also a visual sermon. And it also speaks of great spiritual realities. The washing away of sin, the washing of regeneration, the new birth, total commitment to Christ. And yes, again, it's right that Christian parents bring their children to have this sign put on them. But just as the Jew could not rely on the fact that he had been circumcised in his youth, neither can anyone look back and say, I was baptized and so all is well with my soul. If the reality is not there, then the sign is meaningless. In actual fact, it's more serious than that. Think of a person who has received the sign of circumcision, but he doesn't actually ever enter savingly into the covenant relationship with God. Isn't he in a very serious state? Why did you not personally believe? Why did you not obey? Why did you not trust when in that sign that was put upon you, you were exhorted to do so? And here's a person who has received the sign of baptism, but has not come to the covenant relationship with God through faith in Jesus, the mediator of the covenant. What about that person? His baptism stands as an indictment. Why have you not believed the promises that God has made to you? You were dedicated to God. Why have you not responded in committing your life to Him? You see, we must never be satisfied with the outward observance. The inward reality is what counts. I've used before the illustration of the sign of the hospital, but I like it, so I'll do it again. We'll be doing signs in the morning with the children, and here's this sign of a big capital H. And there's a man who's got a member of his family who's taken ill, and he knows that they need to go to hospital. He gets into the car and he puts the family member in the car and they drive off down the road, and he's hurrying and hurrying because he needs to get to hospital as soon as he possibly can. And he drives down the road and there's the big sign, H. What relief. What a relief. Does he pull over at the side of the road and park his car and say, well, that's it? No. He says, that's the sign, I'll go for the reality, which is another 500 metres down the road, and we'll go to hospital. And young people, some of you this morning, you have been baptized.